Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at Grove Collective. And by the way, you should check out the Bulwark. We have a lot of stuff. We have a really interesting piece by Nicholas Connors. It's not Never Trump, it's Country First. And it's an analysis of the sort of intellectual laziness of labeling people who object to the miasma of corruption of the Trump administration as Never Trump. Also, Jonathan Last has his winners and losers of last night's debate. I have a piece about the hearings that are ongoing called No Mystery. Greg Wiener, great breakdown of Bill Barr's view of the presidency from that Federalist Society's speech. And of course, Kim Whaley has six takeaways from Gordon Sondland's testimony. But in order to break all of this down, because we want to talk about two things. We want to talk about the remarkable testimony, but also the debate that probably nobody in the world really saw. That's not true. So who better to do that than Slate's national political reporter, Will Salatin. And thanks for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Charlie.
Okay, I have a puzzle for you here. So you and I talked back in June. You were on the Bulwark Podcast, and it is still one of our top 10 most listened to, most downloaded podcasts of all time. You got any theories about that? Were we really good? Were you really good? Or were we just tapped into some Slate universe out there?
You know, it's got to be that. I think there's a little bit of kumbaya going on. Probably some thirst on the responsible right for the responsible left. So maybe it's a little dating dance between elements of the two parties that are
dogs and cats lying down together, lions and lambs, something
cat
like that.
Dog loving cats.
A moment of nostalgia for when people could actually talk to one another. I'm not sure that actually ever existed. So you watched the testimony all day on Thursday, right? And then you stayed up and you watched the Democratic debate.
Yeah, that was about 12 hours of testimony on Wednesday. The testimony and morning testimony, afternoon testimony, night debate. Yep.
Yeah, yesterday I do think that the news gods screwed up by just having too much. I mean, somebody should have, you know, called an audible and said, "Okay, the pattern is full." I want to come back to this in a moment. I really got the sense from the Democratic debate that they understood that don't fire real bullets here. I mean, really, nobody's going to pay any attention. I mean, there was nothing really dramatic. The fact that nobody went after Pete Buttigieg was sort of an indication that that either they don't take it seriously or what do you think happened? I mean, do you think there was a little bit of just kind of news cycle hangover last night?
Well, you know, that was my first thought was this is probably great for Buttigieg because he's just now coming up in the polls in Iowa, New Hampshire, and they're probably going to go after him, except because of impeachment and all the news cycle, he's just not going to, the attacks on him won't get the attention. So maybe they won't happen or they'll be muted. And for the first part of the debate, I thought that was going to play out that way. And then just at the end, it's like, a couple of people realized, you know, maybe we should try to take this guy down a little, and then they went after him, and then he clocked him.
Yeah, I mean, he's actually pretty good. Well, let's go back because I want to come back in the second half of the podcast to talk about the debate because I know you're writing about that for Slate, but Jesus, these impeachment hearings and. You and I don't know exactly why you're talking to me rather than listening to Fiona Hill right now because we were listening talking about this. But she comes on and she delivers this absolute slap with Devin Nunes's name just sort of all over it. This is what she had to say about just telling Republicans on the committee, you know, you can do whatever you like, but do not peddle this Russian disinformation, Fiona Hill.
Based on questions and statements I've heard, some of you on this committee appear to believe that Russia and its security services did not conduct a campaign against our country, and that perhaps, somehow, for some reason, Ukraine did. This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves. The unfortunate truth is that Russia was the foreign power that systematically attacked our democratic institutions in 2016. This is the public conclusion of our intelligence agencies, confirmed in bipartisan congressional reports. It is beyond dispute, even if some of the underlying details must remain classified. The impact of the successful 2016 Russian campaign remains evident today. Our nation is being torn apart. Truth is questioned. Our highly professional and expert Korea Foreign Service is being undermined. U.S. support for Ukraine, which continues to face armed Russian aggression, has been politicized. The Russian government's goal is to weaken our country, to diminish America's global role, and to neutralize a perceived U.S. threat to Russian interests. President Putin and the Russian security services aim to counter U.S. foreign policy objectives in Europe, including in Ukraine, where Moscow wishes to reassert political and economic dominance. I say this not as an alarmist, but as a realist. I do not think long-term conflict with Russia is either desirable or inevitable. I continue to believe that we need to seek ways of stabilizing our relationship with Moscow, even as we counter their efforts to harm us. Right now, Russia's security services and their proxies have geared up to repeat their interference in the 2020 election. We are running out of time to stop them. In the course of this investigation, I would ask that you please not promote politically driven falsehoods that so clearly advance Russian interests.
Oh, my. I mean, I don't know whether it was, I was listening to it on Sirius XM, so I didn't get to see whether Devin Nunes is actually sitting there, you know, when he realized that he had just, you know, face planted on all of that. But that was a forceful pushback by Fiona Hill, basically saying, before we get into all the Biden stuff and anything, you know, do not peddle this debunk conspiracy theory bullshit that you're actually pushing out Russian disinformation, that we've really gotten to this point here, that you folks are so anxious to defend the president. I'm now extrapolating on all of this, that you're peddling stuff that was cooked up by what? In Vladimir Putin's propaganda laboratory.
Yeah, you know, what I'd like to believe is going on is a kind of revenge of the hawks. I mean, you have Bolton calling it, the whole thing, a drug deal. You have Fiona Hill saying you're peddling Putin's nonsense. I mean, I think part of what has happened in the Trump administration is there's such an obsession within that administration for doing the opposite of what Obama did and for attacking the Democrats that a lot of these folks don't really notice that in the process they've become tools of various, you know, corrupt and insidious foreign powers. I keep thinking of Mike Pompeo, who's come up a lot in these hearings, and how Pompeo is constantly talking about not about fighting this or that adversary of the United States or standing up to this or that dictator, but about how, you know, his number one enemy, he keeps saying, is the previous administration. And, you know, that makes you a tool. And what we're seeing on this committee is such an antipathy to the Democrats that a lot of these Republicans don't even notice that they're just peddling recycled Russian propaganda in their speeches.
And yesterday, of course, Vladimir Putin spiked the football on this. He's speaking at some sort of an economic forum. He said he's pleased the political battles in Washington have put on the back burner accusations that Russia interfered in the U.S. elections. Here's the direct quote. Thank God, he told an economic forum in the Russian capital on Wednesday. No one is accusing us of interfering in the U.S. elections anymore. Now they're accusing Ukraine. You know, that worked on so many different levels because it was sort of, you know, channeling Trump. People are saying no one now believes that we did it, of course, except that the entire U.S. intelligence service. But I guess congratulations are in order to Vladimir Putin for this disinformation campaign. And I suppose, you know, congratulations for the president of the United States, who's managed to use his influence to put out a story that would have been absolutely not credible 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, you know, every time I hear Putin come out and say basically what Donald Trump said yesterday or has been saying, that we now have the Russian president and the American president echoing each other, I think of that video of Osama bin Laden after 9/11 where he says, you know, we actually didn't mean to take down the buildings. We just were trying to light them on fire or, you know, cause it. And it just played out great for us. And sometimes I think that way about the Russian influence operation in the election of 2016. You know, the intelligence community assessment is mostly that they wanted to hurt Hillary. They didn't really think Trump was going to win. But then Trump wins, and it's been a fantastic success for them. I mean, has there ever been a greater political influence operation than the Russians helping to elect an American president who has proceeded to parrot all of their talking points and undermine NATO and rationalize Russian aggression in Ukraine and everything else they could have hoped for.
So Ambassador Gordon Sondland yesterday, everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. So give me your take on all of that. I have a somewhat contrarian take on that. Yes, there were all of these bombshells and these great revelations, but I guess my take is, you know, folks, we actually knew all this, right? I mean, there is no mystery. Everybody knows the story. It's just we're getting the pieces now on the public record, which is very, very important. But your take on Gordon Sondland and what was going on there, because he clearly seemed to take some of the Republicans by surprise. Apparently, Devin Nunes was handed the wrong notes for his opening remarks because he didn't realize that Sondland was about to throw everybody under the bus.
Yeah, you know, a short takeaway on Sondland is if you're going to try to throw a guy under the bus, make sure he isn't manacled to your ankles, because he's kind of signaling that he's going to take everybody else down with him. I mean, it's like Rudy. Remember, I mean, the first thing Rudy Giuliani did was say, hey, I got all these texts from Kurt Volker, so don't try to throw me under. And Sondland's basically saying, hey, look at all these emails I got. You know, it's hilarious to me watching the hearing where Sondland says, you know, they won't give me access to my records to find out more. Well, no kidding. I mean, you know, every record that Sondland has had access to, he has used to say, oh, I'm not rogue. Don't try to tell me that I'm a rogue operator, because I've got emails from all of you that you all knew about it.
Yeah, I mean, his credibility has some questions, of course, because he's changed his story, and he did, you know, the Republicans seized on the fact that, well, he was just making certain assumptions about the tie between the military aid and the demands. But it again, you know, I have a piece up at the Bulwark where I'm basically saying, like, folks, look, we all know you don't have to be a Rubik's Cube champion to be able to put all this, you know, together here. You know, every one of the Republican defenses and excuses has been dismantled. You know, there was no quid pro quo. Pff, you know, the evidence is all hearsay. We're now getting direct evidence. The Ukrainians never knew about the delay in military aid, but now we're finding out they did, and all of these conspiracy theories. But you know, and we've known what Rudy Giuliani has been trying to do since last May. You know, in May, the New York Times had this big story about how he was going to Ukraine to pressure them to investigate the Bidens, and we've seen all of this stuff, and yet, you know, we're going through all of this, and it just keeps coming back to the fact the Republicans know this. I mean, I don't know what Devin Nunes knows, but I mean, at least Stefanik. I mean, she must know what the narrative is, what the story is, right? I mean, we know what Donald Trump wanted. We know what he did. And so how far are they willing to go to defend this? And the answer is all the way, right? Because it's not about, for them, it's no longer about the evidence or the facts. It's just simply about, we just have to protect Trump. We got to, you know, we hate the Democrats, and we're going to do whatever we have to do. So if we have to move the goalposts every single day, by God, we're here for it.
Okay, Charlie. So listening to you, I realize that there's a lane to your right to defend Donald Trump. So I'm gonna move into that lane.
Please go for it.
Not to actually defend Trump, but the impeachment case itself. So yeah, I agree with you about, you know, Jim Jordan and Stefanik, and these people are just, it's a cynical play. And honestly, half the time when somebody puts a microphone in their face and asks them to talk about the substance of the scandal, they won't. They just talk about the process because they know they don't have a case on the substance. But in terms of proving what Trump did here, the weak point that I think is still there after this week is, okay, Rudy was telling these guys what his demands were for the Ukraine. He was telling Volker and Sondland and these guys, and they were listening to him. And Trump said, talk to Rudy. So you got that connection. What you don't quite have is, what exactly did Trump say to Rudy, right? We don't have that. And as long as that hole is there, there is still the possibility of a defense based on Trump said, talk to Rudy. Rudy then came up with all sorts of crazy nonsense because that's who Rudy is. And Rudy's, you know, trying to defend what he thinks is his client. But Trump didn't actually say exactly, you know, do this and that. Right, so
okay.
We have.
Okay. No, that's right. And that is true. And the fact is that Giuliani was doing stuff that, and we don't have a full picture of what Rudy and his cronies were doing. But by the way, we haven't heard their names enough in these hearings. The fact that he was enmeshed with these Ukrainian crooks who are now facing indictment. So yes, it's certainly true that everything that Rudy Giuliani did and said did not necessarily come from Trump, but Having said that, we do know the broad outlines. We do know that it was only the president who could have stopped that military aid. It was only the president himself who could have denied the Ukrainian president the visit in the Oval Office. We know that he was specifically tying those things together in his own transcript, quote-unquote transcript, of his call to Zelensky. So, you know, yeah, there may have been stuff that Giuliani was freelancing about, but it's pretty obvious that it was Donald Trump who was driving this bus from the get-go.
Yeah, okay, so now let me move
on. And it's also not a criminal case. I mean, it is a political process, and people can make up their own minds as opposed to, you know, the, you know, beyond any reasonable doubt sort of thing.
Right. Okay, so now let me move over to the Democratic side and sort of make the case from their side at this point. Strategically, what I think has happened in the last week is that the Republicans' refusal to allow the administration's refusal to allow various people to testify before the committee who have firsthand knowledge of conversations with Trump and so forth, that's now getting squeezed. Because now that you have Sondland saying, here are all the people who I notified on my emails. Here is what I heard from Rudy, or what we heard from Rudy. Here's what I heard from Trump. You know, the Republicans can say, well, you don't have proof, but they can't really get away with politically. They can't get away with simultaneously saying, you don't have the goods on us, and we're not going to let you talk to the people who did know what was going on directly and who are named in these emails, who are named by these witnesses as having given the directions. So I think the Democrats can move forward to impeachment and will be politically supported in that. They will be in a politically strong position as long as the Republicans are refusing to provide the witnesses who can answer the questions.
Yeah, no, I think that's unanswerable. It, assuming that any merit in any, you know, point is evaluated on merit. I actually have been impressed by the witnesses so far. I thought they have been substantive. I thought they have been succinct. I thought they've been clear. I think they all came off as credible. I guess the only problem politically is whether or not it is the fire hose phenomenon. I think it was somebody who said, was it like a month ago that Alexander Vindman testified? There's so much information. It's coming so fast that you wonder whether or not the voters are going to be able to process it at all. Republicans seem to be rather confident that they won't pay a political price for lining up behind the president in lockdown.
Yeah, and if I were a Republican, I would probably continue with that because they just haven't taken enough of a beating yet. I mean, I've become a complete cynic about this, Charlie. I'm not going to say Republicans don't have a conscience. They're a Republic. First of all, we have the Never Trumpers who clearly have a conscience. But even within the people who are playing along, yeah, I'm sure we have all the off the record quotes about what they think of Trump. But they're not really going to move. The party isn't really going to move until it suffers at least another major beating in an election. Probably lose, you know, you need to probably lose the Senate, maybe a couple of years of having not the White House, not the Senate or the House. Maybe having some major legislation passed against you to where you get the discipline to go back and say, all right, how do we run a clean conservative party? How do we run one that's respectable and that can win a majority? Until that happens, they're just going to keep going with Trump because they haven't suffered enough pain.
No, I think that's completely true. And I don't think that's too cynical. That is just an observation of what's happening. And they've decided that to have a conscience about these things is a luxury. And that they can't afford to do it because this is a binary choice. And they convince themselves that, look, we're either going to be in power or going to be out of power. I'm either going to be relevant or not relevant. And those other folks are going to be so terrible. So this is the price of admission, I guess. I guess I am disappointed, but then I'm used to disappointment with people like Will Hurd and Elise Stefanik, who I wasn't expecting that they would fall in line on this. I mean, there is something to be said for people who would argue that, I'm going to support Trump because of the policies, but I'm going to keep my head down when it comes to his personal conduct. But now it's not about the policies. It's about the conduct, right? And if it means looking the other way when your own political party is pushing Russian propaganda, well, apparently you're willing to do that too.
Yeah. Now, can I come back to Devin Nunes for a minute? Because yeah, I can't get enough of this guy.
Okay. So, neither can I.
he's killing me because here is the ranking member on the Intelligence Committee. Is Steve Castor the Republican counsel Nunes choice? Okay. But Castor, you know, is trying to deliver a fairly the best case that he can for the Trump position. He's just poking holes in the quality of the case against Trump. It's not impeachable. You can't prove this. You can't prove that. Meanwhile, Nunes is going insane. I can't count the number of times that Nunes has used his opening statement or his question period to construct a corrupt theory of Trump's behavior. I mean, here's the ranking member on the Republican committee saying basically on the Intelligence Committee saying the president hates Ukraine because the Ukrainians worked against him, or they wrote a mean op-ed in the 2016 election, and therefore he's out to get Ukraine. Well, that's the freaking case against him. That he, you know, he's that it's all political to him. It's all about him and his petty revenge. It's about him not in 2016. It's about him in 2020. It's not about corruption or anything larger than Donald Trump. And here is Devin Nunes making exactly that case at every opportunity. So it's got to be shocking, you know, to Steve Castor, who's sitting there trying to do his job as the attorney, to have his own client, as it were, undermining his case.
So Devin Nunes at one time must have had a certain level of respectability, right? Otherwise, he wouldn't have become chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Or am I being insufficiently cynical here?
Go with it.
Okay. So, you know, this question which we ask all the time. So what happened to him? Why does he feel he needs to do this? My only theory is that he feels that this is what Trump demands. That Trump does not want it was bad but not impeachable defense. He wants to inject these conspiracy theories, these counter narratives. He wants to inject it directly into the veins of the process. And Devin Nunes is willing to do that. And he apparently feels it necessary because why? I don't know. I do find this kind of puzzling. Because there are, as you point out, there are alternative ways of doing your job where you don't essentially set yourself on fire.
Well, I think Devin Nunes actually believes these conspiracy theories.
I don't know what's worse, whether because I'm just assuming that he can't possibly believe this stuff, so that he's just being dishonest and cynical. So is it even worse if this is in his head that he really believes this stuff? Okay, go on.
Yeah, I don't know which is worse. I'd have to think about that. It's just that from watching him during these hearings, I get the impression that he is inside his own little bubble. I mean, I don't really know, Charlie. I'm not talking to Devin Nunes. I'm just seeing what I'm seeing. And I think that there are some people who are lost inside the confirmation bias bubble of Fox News and Hannity and you know, the endless conspiracy theories. Nunes has been at this for so long. I think he is basically using his own product, as they say in the illegal drug industry. And, I can't imagine, it doesn't make any strategic sense to me.
Right.
It doesn't make political sense what he's doing. So yeah, I think he kind of believes it. I mean, you know, there's a need if the actual narrative on the table about what Trump did with Zelensky and the Ukrainians is kind of indefensible, then you got to go with the alternative narrative of the Bidens and the corruption of the Democrats and how it's really about this interior story. And that's where he's gone.
Wow. You know, I've been thinking about my good friend Ron Johnson and where he's going. And I actually do think that he probably is believing some of the stuff that he's pushing out, that you can go into the rabbit hole and after a while, you forget what sunlight actually looks like. You know, if you've been reading some of the squirrelier stuff from the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal and getting your news off of Fox News, what's possible for you to believe? But it is extraordinary. I don't know. By the way, speaking of Twitter, I've been accused of like reading Twitter too much. But I don't know if you saw. I posted a link to an Art Buchwald column from 1973. Did you happen to catch that, or were you like working for a living?
No, I haven't seen that.
Okay, this will be a treat for you. Okay. It's July 12th, 1973. And I wasn't a huge Art Buchwald fan, but I mean, this is my generation. This is a, you know, okay boomer type thing. And he has a thing, response list for Nixon backers. And I won't read the whole thing, but it'll give you a flavor. He says, these are difficult times for people who are defending the Nixon administration. No matter where they go, they're attacked by pseudo-liberals, McGovern lovers, heterosexual constitutionalists, and paranoid John Dean believers. So as a public service, I'm printing out instant responses for loyal Nixonites when they're attacked at a party. And you can cut it out and put it in your party. So here are the excuses that Nixon, he was saying that Nixon backers would use. And this is 1973 when it was looking bad, although he still had a year to go. Number one, everyone does it. Number two, what about Chappaquiddick? Number three, a president can't keep track of everything his staff does. Number four, the media is blowing the whole thing up. Number five, whatever Nixon did was for national security. Number six, the Democrats are sore because they lost the election. Number seven, are you going to believe a rat like John Dean or the president of the United States? Number eight, wait till all the facts come out. Number nine, what about Chappaquiddick? Number 10, if you impeach Nixon, you get Agnew. Number 11, the only thing wrong with Watergate is they got caught. What about Chappaquiddick? It happens in Europe all the time. People will be against Nixon no matter what. I'd rather have a crook in the White House than a fool. Well, LBJ used to read FBI. You get the flavor. What's interesting about it is it's pretty much identical to the kinds of defenses that you get for Trump. It's just reboot it. And what about Chappaquiddick? Which was kind of their version of what about her emails, right?
Yeah, it's uncanny. That's a great list. It's disturbing. But should I be hopeful, though, that even though they were saying the same things that the Republicans are saying now, that Nixon eventually had to leave?
Yeah, you know, that idea crossed my mind. But then I remembered, OK, it's not 1973 anymore. And you don't have Fox News, and you don't have all those other folks and everything. You don't have the Devin Nunes of the world. Although, you know, what is interesting is that the Republican defenders of Nixon really were pretty adamant right up until the end. And even the most extreme Nixon defenders at some point broke. And they broke because of the smoking gun, which was a tape in which the president is talking about an attempted obstruction of justice that never actually took place. So we think about what constituted an obstruction of justice and what constituted a smoking gun back in 1974. And today people would just shrug it off. Well, it didn't happen, right? Well, they didn't actually do it. So no harm, no foul. I mean, you can almost write the Hugh Hewitt column off of it, right?
Yeah. So if we don't get a smoking gun, if we don't get that kind of a tape here, do they leave him? I'm guessing not. And I'm pretty sure that I've seen public opinion data that show that negative partisanship has increased to a point beyond where we were at that point. And that just glues the Republican Party to its president in a way that wasn't true back then.
Well, I'll tell you what I wrote in the Bulwark today. I said no smoking gun is going to change any of this because the GOP knows the gun was fired. They know who fired it, and they know where the bodies can be found. They just don't care. So it's like we already have the smoking gun. It doesn't matter where we're going on all of this. So have there been any surprises for you so far in the hearings? Because there have been moments where you go, whoa. What was your whoa moment?
I don't know if I had a whoa moment. I was curious to see what Gordon Sondland would be like. I'd looked at his deposition, but I hadn't seen him testify in person. And I thought, man, this guy is screwed. You know, he is really going to get nailed for perjury. Then he starts talking, and pretty soon I'm like, you know, I get you, man. I understand. First of all, I found him charming. You know, he and Volcker as characters, you could totally see how they got played.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoyed everybody talking about how brilliant Kurt Volcker was and, you know, what a charming guy Sondland was. And to me, these two characters are exactly the kind of, I mean, they're not exactly stupid, but they're so manipulable.
Yeah, I know.
And, you know, it really reminded me the whole picture of them and Rudy doing this backstage diplomacy, working around the State Department, reminded me of nothing so much as the way American diplomats deal with foreign dictators. The colonel in, you know, Honduras or whatever it is, yeah, he does kill a few people now and then, but we need to learn how to work with him. You know, he really, really likes caviar. So if we can get him some caviar. And with Trump, it's like, yeah, we have this sort of corrupt American president who wants, you know, help in the campaign. If we can just get the Ukrainians to sort of satisfy his demands, I think we can work him around to supporting our policy on Ukraine.
Yeah, I had mixed feelings. I think everybody had mixed feelings on Sondland, right? They were having a hard time deciding whether they were going to beat up on him or they were going to be sympathetic to him, and they sort of went back and forth. But, you know, I was listening this morning to the testimony about that phone call at the restaurant where you just imagine sort of this rich guy, you know, had bought himself an ambassadorship with $1 million. He's sitting around with these embassy employees, and he's like, I'm going to call the president. I'm going to get the president on the line, you know. And then, of course, he has to hold the phone slightly away because the president's voice is so loud. I mean, that's kind of – it's just sort of a – I mean, maybe it's just a Trumpian thing. These rich guys showing off and, you know, being way over their skis.
Right. My favorite detail from that story is actually not anything anybody seems to talk about. It's that while they're having the lunch prior to the phone call with Trump, what are they talking about? Sondland's sitting there with U.S. embassy staff. They're talking about marketing strategies for his hotels. Like, that's the normal part of the Trump administration, is sort of using public resources to advance. You're actually, you know, running your business. Why not? The president does the same thing. And so, like, that's the normal corruption, on top of which you get layered this hilarious story about calling the president.
Yeah. And I like the part where Sondland is, they're saying, well, did you basically say that the president of Ukraine loves the president of the United States' ass? Well, yeah, because that's the way the president and I talk to each other.
Okay. Right.
And then, of course, they have to talk about the rapper in Sweden, because that's what's important, and what to tell the Kardashians about it. It is a picture that I don't know that historians are going to be able to capture, but novelists at some point certainly will have to. Well, I will tell you that I did have that whoa moment yesterday. I was in D.C. and I was kind of expecting, as usual, because I'm always expecting to be disappointed, that Sondland was going to somehow, you know, weasel out of all of this or wimp out. And then when he starts going, yes, there was a quid pro quo. Yes, we were following the president's order. I did sit up and went, whoa, this is interesting. But I suppose I'm also really struck by all of the folks from the quote unquote deep state who are willing to come out and deliver really powerful, direct, succinct testimony, that when you think about the level of risk and all of the efforts to intimidate them and smear them, all of the consequences for doing it, this breaking of the dam is really quite something. And I was, you know, I mean, you know, the Trump administration has not been subtle at all about the fact that we will destroy you. We will out you if you're a whistleblower. We will go after your job. We will, you know, the suggestion out there that there might be some sort of investigation or criminal investigation. And you could certainly imagine a lot of people going home telling their wives, I would like to testify, but it's not worth it. Let's just keep our heads down, whatever, we'll bite our tongue. And yet, these folks are coming out there and they are giving this testimony. I mean, whoa.
Yeah, you know, what I'd really like to believe as a lesson from this so far is that, you know, there's a cynical view that you just lie. This is how it works in Russian disinformation. The regime lies. Everybody's exactly what you said. I don't want to stick my head up. I don't want to get in trouble. Let's just go along with it. And there's decades of history in communist countries, totalitarian countries that are like this, right? I'd like to believe, first of all, that America isn't quite at that point yet, but also that just in general, people, when they go about their daily lives, including working in the United States government, it's just, there's a certain kind of friction in lying. It's just uncomfortable. You have to make things up. Then you have to reconcile it with the actual facts. Then it's the Mark Twain line, right? If you tell the truth, you don't have to remember anything. If you're lying, you're constantly having to patch things up, and that there's something, people just don't like lying, you know, just deal with you other people in the normal commerce of everyday life. You just need to trust people. You need to be honest. You know, it just makes everything work better. So that, yeah, the government is full of people who really don't like to lie. And if they're called up and said, what happened here, they just kind of feel like, I'm going to tell the truth.
No, I think you're probably right there. And I suppose that is one of those moments that's got to rattle the White House a little bit. And kind of we all now are wondering, what is John Bolton thinking? Is he going to come forward, or is he going to keep his powder dry until the Senate trial? Who knows? Okay, now I wanted to talk to you about the last night's debate. I know that you were writing about this for Slate. I have some takes on it. I think you probably watched it a lot more closely than I did. So let's dive into what your takeaway from that debate was right after a word from our sponsor. Did you know that 70% of people say they want to use natural products, but only 2% do? That's why Grove Collaborative makes finding healthy, affordable, effective products easy and convenient. And now, more than 500,000 American households shop Grove for their healthy home essentials. Grove Collaborative is the online marketplace that delivers all natural home, beauty, and personal products directly to you. They take the guesswork out of going green. Every Grove product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. My first box arrived, and it had just an incredible array of products that my wife and I are going to be trying out. I mean, it is an amazing smorgasbord of choices. Then they deliver all of your home essentials right to your front door, and they have this huge selection of sustainable plant-based products, including all the big brands that I love and I trust, like Mrs. Meyers and Method. Everything they carry is safer for you, better for the planet, and really works. In place of the harsh chemicals, they use natural ingredients that smell fresh and leave your house sparkling. Look, we're all busy. I certainly am. And I know that I don't have time to waste buying detergent and toilet paper, and neither do you. So give it a try and get some me time back in your day. Because with Grove, you don't have to shop multiple stores or search endlessly online to get all the natural goods you need for you and your family. They have everything that I need in one place, which... I don't want to spend a lot of time doing this, but I want to get quality stuff. So, and they have the best selection of natural home and personal care products. Things for the house, my grandkids, my dog, even some fun personal things for me. So join more than 500,000 families who trust Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier and healthier. Plus, the shipping is fast and free on your first order. For a limited time, when listeners go to grove.co/bulwark, you'll get a free 5-piece gift set from Mrs. Meyers and festive holiday scents like peppermint or Iowa pine. So go to grove.co/bulwark to get this exclusive holiday offer. That's grove.co/bulwark. Okay, we're back with Will Salatin, the national political correspondent. Do you call yourself a correspondent? Is it correspondent? Is that a word?
Yeah, I've got some title like national correspondent.
Okay, for Slate. So you stayed up late and you watched this debate. Conventional wisdom is not a lot of shots fired, nothing much changed.
Yeah, I thought not a lot of shots fired early in the debate, and I thought just in the last half hour, a lot of people, the backbenchers, woke up and decided to throw some punches, and then it got a little more interesting. That wasn't my main takeaway from the debate. My main takeaway was that this is what, the fifth, sixth debate? I can't remember where we are at this point, but the debate started out with the primary field running hard to the left, and you know, Bernie and Warren, and there was a lot of excitement, and we're going to – and then there was a lot of fear, of course, from the sort of Trump-averse center and right that the Democratic Party is not going to give us an alternative in this election. And now we seem to be at a phase where the Democratic field is moving a little bit back to the center. That was definitely my impression from last night.
No, it feels like there's been a pivot. And you tell me whether or not, because I obviously have a different perspective on all of this, that there was, in fact, the last time you and I were talking was in June, when there was a really kind of an oh wait moment. You know, is this party really going to embrace Medicare for all, and are really going to be banning private health insurance and providing health insurance to illegal immigrants and decriminalizing border crossing? Are they really going to do all of that? And that seemed to be the trajectory at the time. It seemed, though, that when Elizabeth Warren finally came out with her Medicare for all payment plan, and people looked at it and went, wow, that's. You know, we're not sure it adds up, or if it does add up, we're not sure that it's sellable. She could really lose this election. it felt as if the brakes on her, was slamming on the brakes on her campaign. And you look at the poll numbers and all of her momentum has disappeared immediately. You started getting this buzz about other candidates who are going to jump in the race, like Bloomberg, Deval Patrick. Is that your sense that there was kind of a pulling back when people began to confront the possibility that moving too far to the left was going to reelect Donald Trump?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in cowardice. I believe cowardice moves the world. And I think this is actually a two-stage process. I think number one is exactly what you said. It's there are, for various reasons, some about policy, some about the math of Warren's proposal, the magnitude of it, people sort of stepping back from that. The sheer sort of ordering people off their private insurance and people not being comfortable with that. So there were some substantive policy problems that people had with Warren's ideas. But I think we're now in the second stage where, as a result of some of the attacks on Warren and her difficulty explaining the plan and her general approach to things, she's slid a little in some of the early state polls. And once the Democrats realized that the polls were moving in a different direction, I think that accounts for last night. So you have Warren sliding a little bit. Bernie is also sliding. Biden is holding his own. I mean, he's not doing great. He's also slid a little bit, but nationally he's holding a lead that a lot of folks thought he might have squandered more of by now. And, you know, Pete Buttigieg has come up in the first two states, and he's sort of viewed as playing to Warren's right, you know, particularly on Medicare for All. So I think an idea has emerged in the field that there's more of a lane in the center than to the left of Warren. And so that's where some of the candidates are going.
Mm. Okay. And Pete Buttigieg has punched her pretty hard on the Medicare for All. So let's do kind of a lightning round here to give me your take on various people. I'm going to give you the names. You tell me how they did. Pete Buttigieg. Was he the winner last night?
Yeah, I thought he had a bad first quarter. And then he got warmed up a little bit. And in the fourth quarter, he was ready to counterpunch. And he counterpunched on what Gabbard came after him. There was a little bit from Harris. I forget who else came after him. But Amy Klobuchar. I thought Pete's counterpunching was terrific.
Hmm. Okay, let's talk about it. So Amy Klobuchar, because there were early on, some people thought she was turning in a pretty good performance. And if in fact there's a lane for moderates, she's an obvious candidate.
Yeah, I thought she had a good night. I thought she was probably a little bit patronizing in the stuff about experience when she was going after Buttigieg, but that's her calling card. I mean, I view Amy Klobuchar as, like, if you think of this as a Tour de France or a NASCAR, she's in the car right behind Buttigieg. And if she can sort of go in his wake in that sort of center lane and then knock him out, then she can move into the front. But I think she needed to make a move, and she's trying to figure out a way, and she tried to do that last night.
Okay. Joe Biden. I mean, Joe Biden was Joe Biden, right? I mean, he had his little, you know, punching back gaffe, but it's almost as if people look at sort of crazy Uncle Joe and discount that.
Yeah, this is one where you and I disagree. Cringe when every time Biden opens his mouth, and he had several gaffes, I thought, last night. They weren't fatal. The one about, you know, Carol Moseley Braun, about how, like, the only black woman in the Senate, that one really, that hurt a little bit. But, I mean, Joe, let's be honest, he starts off in his first answer and says, "I got two things to say," and he forgets number two. And that, you know, and the end was kind of like that too. I forget he had a problem with his closing, but Joe just has a lot of trouble keeping his head together. And I think it's just age.
Yeah, my standards are lower. As long as his eye doesn't explode again on national television, it's a win. You know, it's just, I'm just waiting for it. The eye don't blow up. Bernie Sanders.
Bernie seems to be the only one. Well, he and Steyer are sticking to the left, and you know, Bernie. What they asked him, they gave him a setup question about, you know, people at your rallies who were saying lock him up about the president, and Bernie's like, yeah, they should lock him up. So, God bless Bernie. He's hanging out there.
Yeah, Steyer just seems like a total, like, lightweight. You know, looking at him, like, why is he on the stage? Well, of course, we know why he's on the stage.
I was going to split a gut about Steyer going on and on about taking on corporate power. I could not believe this billionaire being Mr. Anti-Corporate. So, you know, Steyer continues to exist because no one is taking down Tom Steyer. But if he were ever to get to the point where it was necessary, it would take about 5 minutes.
Okay. Kamala Harris.
You know, I think Kamala is a great debater, just a great, great debater. She's not good at some other things. And one reason why she has imploded is that after her great first debate, then when she had to sort of talk policy and sort of deal with people coming at her over various things and her record, she's just not good at any of that stuff. But man, is she good on a debate stage. I think she projects strength. She's smart. She has her talking points. She knows how to hit. And I think she just has tremendous presence. If I could pick somebody to be on a debate stage just to do the debate part against Trump, I would pick her.
Okay, so I'm going to be canceled for saying this. I'm going to be canceled just completely. But my favorite YouTube segments from the debate are watching her and Tulsi Gabbard. I mean, just the two of them. They have chemistry. You know what I'm saying? I mean, when they hit each other so hard, and it's remarkable. So
what Harris punching down on Gabbard, I get, maybe she's not punching down anymore. Maybe she's punching up at this.
But Gabbard is pretty much, I mean, she's like done as a Democrat, right? I mean, when you had the Trump war room tweeting out her attacks on the Democratic Party, you basically saw, okay, so Tulsi's got her own path.
Right.
She's going to go, you know, she'll be on Fox News a lot.
Can I just say, it drove me crazy to be watching Cory Booker standing outside of Tulsi Gabbard on that stage. That was insane.
So let's talk about Cory Booker, because he had an absolutely outstanding closing remark, didn't he? I mean, that was what Cory could be. But he really is sort of the guy on the outside lane. I mean, he had to. Probably his most memorable point before that was reminding people that he was also a Rhodes Scholar. Yeah, right. Rhodes Scholar here, too.
Right. Right. Actually, my favorite thing about Cory was not the Rhodes Scholar part. It was the mayor part. It was like, here are all these senators, right, who are trailing the mayor of South Bend, Indiana in early state polls. And they're like, how the hell is this happening? You know, I can't believe this guy. Amy Klobuchar, of course, is like, you know what? You know, it sure is a man's world when the mayor of South Bend can be leading me after I've been in the Senate these years. But Cory takes the approach of, hey, you know what? I was a mayor, and I can't remember. How much of that debate did he spend going back and talking about being a mayor? It's like he wanted to roll back his resume to the days when he had that kind of experience.
Okay, now, have I asked you about everybody, or have I just zipped by people that I don't care about? We talked about Warren. Andrew Yang, okay. I mean, he's likable, he's candid, he's bright, he's glib, but, you know, he's Andrew Yang, so.
Yeah, I find it hard to take him as seriously as others do.
Okay,
but
so.
He's to listen to.
So what is your take on the whole Mike Bloomberg, Deval Patrick thing? Because I'm getting the feeling that these are the guys who people in the media bubble take way more seriously than voters are taking them.
Yeah, I don't. I think so. Before I was saying that cowardice explains most of human behavior, I think ego explains the rest. Mm. And these are just a couple of really, really big egos. I mean, to think that the 20-something candidates who started this race and the dozen who are still in it, or probably more, are not sufficient. And to like ignore, your pollster must have told you, actually, you know what? Democrats are pretty happy with this field, and like historically happy with this field. But do you think, no, they need me. They need my genius and my charisma. This is something, by the way, that, have you ever seen a woman do this? Have you ever seen a woman say, you know, the 20 candidates who are in there don't quite have what I have. So a year late, I'm going to come in at the end because everybody's really waiting for me.
Hillary.
Well, Hillary
was making no noises like that, right?
So, yeah, but she's not coming in this field.
No. But the thing about Mike Bloomberg is, you know, he's 78 years old and he's a billionaire. This is exactly what Democrats are craving, right? Another 78-year-old billionaire running for president. And I suppose people are telling him how great he is. But it was, you know, there was a lot of pushback saying, you know, if you have all this money and you want to put it in, why don't you use it for something constructive? And he seems to have paid attention because he says he's going to be dumping, is the number $100 million? This is
right.
Way above my pay. $100 million into anti-Trump efforts, which is not nothing.
Right. And if I were going to construct the most sympathetic portrayal of what Bloomberg is doing, I would say, A, he's doing exactly what you just described, trying to help take out Trump. And B, he's putting his name in the later states, and maybe he thinks of himself as a backup if we end up with most likely Warren as the leading candidate at that point for the nomination. And if somehow Biden has imploded and nobody else has come through, maybe Bloomberg is supposed to be the alternative. But I don't see any polling that says people would prefer Bloomberg to the other centrist nominees.
Yeah. So your scenario, if I'm reading this correctly, is you have Biden still in the poll position. You have Buttigieg, who's certainly moving up, if not, you know, I mean, he's right there. Klobuchar right behind him. So that if Joe Biden's eye explodes on stage and Mayor Pete moves into the lead, and then people go, yeah, this 37-year-old gay guy might not be the most electable, then it's going to be Klobuchar who's going to have the next sort of shot at it. Where in this scenario does Bloomberg come in, I guess?
Yeah, Bloomberg... I mean, at that point, the Bloomberg theory would have to be Biden's gotten smoked in the first two. He's imploding. For whatever reason, people aren't converging behind Buttigieg or Klobuchar, or they can't. Maybe they don't have – I mean, Buttigieg has money. Klobuchar, I don't know how much. I think she has less. I don't know if she has enough to, like, compete in Super Tuesday and so forth. So maybe Bloomberg is like, well, I'm the guy with money who can sort of, like, present an alternative. But really, really, I think it's just ego. But my scenario of how this plays out at this point, I mean, I remain bearish on Biden. I mean, I think he will gradually deflate. Mm-hmm. And I still think there's a strong case that Warren comes out of this thing. And I'm ecstatic to see Mayor Pete come up, because I think he is a better alternative to Warren than Biden is. But that's my weird view.
So Deval Patrick seemed like the anointed one out of Obama world, at least for 5 minutes there. You know, on two things. Number one, another reflection of the panic of the rise of Elizabeth Warren. Tell me if I'm wrong on this. But also not exactly a vote of confidence in Joe Biden's durability. But you saw what happened to him last night. Oh, my gosh. Deval Patrick's supposed to have an event at Morehouse College, and an organizer with the college who planned the event then tells CNN that Patrick cancels the event at the last moment when he arrived and learned that he wouldn't have any audience. Actually, there were two people who came.
Wow.
And the CNN reporter has this picture of this completely empty room. So it's just like, okay, so this is not launching. This is almost at Mark Sanford level of, you know, having an event that one person shows up at. But you're Deval Patrick. You're the guy. You're right. Obama's BFF. You're the former governor of Massachusetts. This is tough for the Democrats right now, isn't it? Because there's so many of them, and impeachment does seem to be just sucking up all the media at, you know, oxygen, to use that cliche again.
If Deval Patrick were a more attractive candidate, people would show up. I mean, you get that few people. That doesn't happen by accident. I mean, these guys, I can't say it enough. These guys, Bloomberg, Patrick, whoever else decides to come in, they have to have looked at – I mean, Bloomberg's rich. He's got to have run polls. He's got to have looked at polls. He's got to know that the numbers are saying, you know, they're really not clamoring for somebody new. They're really not necessarily clamoring for you. You might be able to catch fire, but it's not out there in the numbers. And then to show up at an event or to find out that no one's there – that is a kind of perfect physical manifestation. I mean, you need that manifestation of an in-your-face rejection to absorb what the numbers should have already told you.
So what is your advice to Democrats on impeachment going forward in terms of moving fast, moving slow, getting it done before the end of the year? Do you have a feel for that?
Well, you know, the Watergate line was follow the money, and here I think it's just follow the evidence. I don't know about the speed of it. You know, what do you do when you've sort of telegraphed that you're going to try to do this thing in a month, and then Gordon Sondland says, here, I can hear the following 10 high-ranking Trump administration officials all knew what was going on.
Yes.
As it was his phrase, everybody's in the loop. Well, now what do you do? I mean, you've got to sort of demand that they testify. Are you going to say, well, we got a good enough case as it is? You're going to drag this out through the courts? I don't think the Democrats are really in control of that process. They have the votes. Yeah, they have the votes to impeach, but they're going to have an incomplete case, and the case is going to be incomplete because of stonewalling by the administration. Seems to me, if I were in their shoes, I would focus the case now around the stonewalling. Here's the evidence we have. They have the answers beyond what we know, and they're not answering it.
No, I think you're right. And the possibility here, of course, is the problem, because if you do follow the evidence, you could be lost down, you know, all sorts of paths. And because there's conceivably so many areas of corruption that you could do. I mean, there might be an entire universe about Trump's efforts to get the Chinese to go after the Bidens that would be every bit as juicy as Ukraine. Who knows? You could also have a trickle of more documents and more testimony, because even last night it came as a surprise that there's now evidence, and apparently there's documentary evidence, that the Ukrainians did know that the military aid had been withheld far sooner than anybody had really thought before. So, you know, this is one of those things where it is a tough call. It's a genuinely tough call, because you don't want to get bogged down forever. You don't want it to go into the summer necessarily. You don't want to leave too much of the important stuff on the table. And yet, you're right, you have to pursue some of these leads. There's no way of going forward without at least asking the questions. And if it does come down to be about the cover-up, then, well, there's an extra article of impeachment right there on the table. There was with Nixon as well.
Yeah, you know, to your point about about things coming up in the hearing and where the evidence goes, and this reminds me of one of my biggest shocks from Wednesday. Here's Gordon Sondland talking about, this is like a side point, right? This is not the main point, but he says, yeah, we have this July 10th meeting at the White House, and we're talking about whether to have the phone call with Zelensky on before or after the Ukrainian parliamentary elections in late July. And several of us, and he names himself and Perry and Volker, I don't remember who else. Yeah, we all thought that we should do it before the elections, because that would help Zelensky win the parliamentary elections. Like, oh my freaking God, you guys you're just testifying that you're trying explicitly to interfere in Ukraine's elections while we're talking about various interference in our elections. So, yeah, and stuff like that just pops up during the hearings, because there's so much corruption, and this administration is full of so many people who, you know, didn't think twice about doing what Bolton calls a drug deal here and there. So, yeah, there's just an endless supply of this craziness.
Well, you know, I keep thinking about that black book. Remember the role of the black book played? You know, Paul Manafort was the, you know, chairman of the Trump campaign until somebody came up with, that's called the black book, right? Basically this document in Ukraine showing how much money he had been paid, $10 million. Well, somebody leaked that. That came from somewhere. How many other books like that are around there? You know, one of these guys, what's Parnas's first name? Is he Lev? Yeah, Lev Parnas. You know, he could show up and say, and yeah, by the way, I've been taping all my phone calls with Rudy Giuliani. Or, you know, here are the check stubs that we wrote to Devin. I mean, who knows what these guys might have?
Right. Well, Parnas claims to have stuff that if he could produce it, if he could back it up, would certainly take down Giuliani.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well,
he's got stuff that he claims that he's claiming a personal conversation with Trump to administer this. So I don't believe him. I didn't believe in the P tape, and I don't believe Lev Parnas has those kind of goods on Trump. Too good to be true. But if he did, yeah, he would take him down.
Well, this is the thing, is though, guys like this do keep insurance policies. So, okay, now I'm going down my own conspiracy theory rabbit hole, which I don't want to do. In fact, I wrote a piece early on in impeachment telling Democrats, you know, don't speculate, stick to the facts, stick to the evidence, and listen to me right now. So we'll see where we're going. So consensus, though, good night for Pete Buttigieg last night. And the Democrats have managed not to screw up impeachment. Would we agree on that?
Yeah, agree
so
on
far. So far. Will Salatin, thank you so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very much.
My pleasure, Charlie. Thanks.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast, brought to you by Grove Collective. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again. All right. Thanks a lot. Good luck with your piece.
Hey, thanks, Charlie.
All right. Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, Jim. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.